Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And at this time, we begin the TechNet in Landmark. And this is TechNet number 1474 of the series that began 31 years ago, September of 1982. I give a little bit of a preamble in the beginning to explain what it is. I know you guys have heard it an awful lot of times, but we do hear from our emails that new people are joining us all the time. By word of mouth, people in various areas through IRLP and Echolink and other things like that, they link their particular local repeater to this particular one, and all of a sudden people start hearing this for the first time, even though it's been around for 3 decades. And they want to know what it is, and it's a gathering of the clan where the amateurs in the New York City area primarily, although it's quite often from the outer areas, let me drop. We try to tap into that brain power that we think is in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, Long Island, and these amateurs teach each other how the electronics works, how ham radio works. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. The one you're listening to right now, 2-meter FM repeater type ham radio with various kinds of interconnect. That's just one of the 26 kinds of ham radio. It's an extremely educational hobby, so before, if you become disappointed with it for whatever reason, before you completely give it up, try one of the other 25 kinds. The main thing that we believe takes place is that when a society, group of people, or an individual really wants to learn things, the quickest way to learn things is to have curiosity. Real progress mankind makes is by way of curiosity. So the curious hams are the ones who we believe gather on this particular net, and they discuss feed lines and transmission lines and antennas and propagation and transmitters and receivers and all the electronics that goes in between them, antenna tuners and PI networks and so on. We discuss all of that to try to get everyone to understand how it works. And one of the things we've been discovering over the last couple of years is that the most basic kind of antenna in the world that we know of, let me drop. The most basic kind of antenna is a dipole or half of a dipole called a monopole. Since that's been around forever, and it's the basic feed element inside of a Yagi log periodic. A half of a dipole, which is a monopole, is the main probe that's inside of a waveguide to coax adapter, so feed horns for parabolic dish antennas and horn antennas. All of those are a dipole or a monopole. Therefore, you would assume that that particular element, the most basic element, is well understood. We're slowly discovering it's not well understood. And the books give you very poor information to describe how it really works. And they make it sound like it's rocket science. You talk to a guy who's a good ham radio tinkerer. He has discovered a lot of things about dipole-like antennas, what makes them work well and what makes them not work well. So that's one of the many subjects we discuss. The menu we worked our way into, let me drop. Way back in 1982 when the TechNet began, it used to be 1 hour long. People were complaining it wasn't long enough. It became 2, 3, and now it's 4 hours. Starts at 8 o'clock on Sunday night and runs until midnight. At midnight, the repeater we're on right now gets turned off. That's my request, because some of these guys, I like gathering guys that have got enthusiasm and curiosity, but there's a limit. Some of these guys get so enthusiastic they would go into the sunrises again. Some of us have got to go to work the next day, so that's not quite the right way to do it. When it comes to your not being able to stay long enough for the TechNet, there's a way around that. In other words, if a person has to leave at 9 o'clock and it goes on for another 3 hours and you want to know what took place, there is a website where almost all of the TechNets have been recorded for the last 6.5 years. And that's Mike Perry's website, KC2NJI. You go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Go to amateurradio.tangovictor, that website. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and start downloading the TechNets and listening to it. There are people who will record that onto their portable device and listen to it while they're driving, while they're on the train, at noon hours. And that's one way they can get around the problem that they can't stay until midnight when the TechNet ends. Good job. Over the years, we have worked up a kind of a menu. It's an evolving thing. K2 can't please everybody, but the way we've worked onto it, and the way we come onto it, is that we take check-ins for people, only those who have a question or a comment. Don't need a long list of people with their call letters telling us they're listening. After 31 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. And we take those questions and answers, or questions and comments, for the first hour, hour and a half. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who's the man who gathers the mailbag information. For those who don't yet have their ham license or don't have the equipment so they can talk to us live on the TechNet, they send John a email, a snail mail, a pigeon message, whatever, and John will select two, three, or four of those that he thinks have general interest. And 3 weeks ago, we hit an all-time high. John had 283 mailbag responses, emails and whatever, 283 of them, because the previous week we got into some pretty hot subjects and people wanted to make some further comments and ask some further questions. Thank goodness he's down to a slightly lower number than that these days. Let me drop. After we handle a few of the mailbag questions, then Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And John and I get quite a number of emails from people who say that, boy, that's one of my favorite sections. I really want to know what's going on in space. Again, these are curious people, and some of the most curious people in the world end up working for National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and they're making an awful lot of progress in figuring out how all this stuff in space is working. How did we get here? How are we alone? After that, we go into deeper subjects for the rest of the night. And not everybody appreciates that, and we understand that. I'm also kind of, I have to accept the fact that not everyone is curious. Once in a while, I'll run into a ham radio operator who's perfectly happy saying, I don't want to know how this stuff works. If it doesn't work, I bring it to a guy that fixes it. I turn the key on the car. If it doesn't work, I bring it to the repair shop. I don't want to know how it works. Thank goodness there's only a small percentage of people that way. But for them, it works. A real engineering type person, from my point of view, wants to know how things work, how to make it work better. They'd like to understand it, and they trade that information back and forth with their friends. Let me drop. And one further thing is that Hal, K6DPZ, for the last few months has told us that if people want a brief question as opposed to the full answer, if they want a brief answer, they can tell Hal, and Hal believes that he's quite good at giving a more compact answer. My answers tend to be much more verbose. A certain percentage of the people say they want the whole answer. We used to ask when people signed in, do you want the briefer or the long answer? And what I soon discovered is the high percentage of the people would say, please be brief until you get to my question. I want to hear all the information. Hal also has volunteered the fact that he has spent many years on classic pieces of ham radio equipment. Collins and I can't even think of the brand names, but you know what I mean. Collins, Radio Shack is not the right one. because Hal has spent quite a bit of time collecting ham radio equipment and repairing it, if you want to know about older pieces of equipment, make sure you tell us that you want Hal to give that particular answer. Okay, this time we're going to take check-ins. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. And the word yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, N2EO, rich and yes. So when any check-ins, give me your call letters and name right now, K2LIW.
K2MC.
K2MC.
Rich.
N2EL. Hey, so far we've picked up Rich and Mel, in that order. Also, I should mention the fact that we did have a check-in last week from NK2T, I think it is, Joe, who checked in last week, and we didn't get back to him soon enough. So if Joe checks in tonight, he goes to the top of the list because he checked in last week, and we didn't get to...
Repeater, time out.
As I say, Joe NK2T checked in last week, and we didn't get a chance to talk to him. So when he checks in tonight, he goes to the top of the list. Okay, so far, as I said, we've got Rich, Mel, possibly Joe. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? give me your call letters and name right now.
M2XGN, after pull.
US2N with the space report. Good evening to everybody on the net.
Okay, we've got Wes and Paul. But I think there's another person trying to check in. Give me your call letters and name one more time. The person who's checking in with either a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
KD2CGY, and my name is Ed, and I have a question.
2BHY, I joined in here.
Okay, I think we pick up 2 that time. Jim, KD2BHY, was after, I think it was Ed. It sounded like Kilo, Delta 2, Charlie, Juliet, Yankee. Did I have that correct, Ed? Go ahead.
It's Charlie, Tango, Yellow.
Okay. Charlie, Tango, Yellow, Yankee. We got you, Ed. And we've got you, Jim. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Victor Echo 3, X-Ray Sierra Hotel, yes.
And Victor X-Ray 3, Victor Echo 3, X-Ray Sierra Hotel, I should know your name. Please tell me your name again, sir.
Your name is Christian, thank you.
Very fine, Christian. Okay, we got more than enough to get started. Rich has announced earlier today that he has a real hot question. So, the hot question from Massapequa Park. From Rich, go right ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick Driver, first off, how are you getting in?
You're getting in now reasonably well, Rich, so please proceed.
Okay, Dick, my question is an antenna question. I guess you would call it the announcer's infinitesimal dipole. I forget who wrote that book where he described it. Work was also done by Jerry Civic, W2FMI. The reason I'm bringing it up, Dick, when I moved to Massapequa Park from Whitestone, Queens, I brought the antennas with me, one of which is a Cushcraft R8 halfway vertical, and I fully intended originally to put it up along with some other stuff, but then as you well know, I was diagnosed with an abscess on the spine and some other stuff, and all of a sudden, like practically overnight, I become a paraplegic. I have to use a wheelchair. So I want to keep stuff. What he is putting up, you could go to the MSJ website. They make a hoop antenna. It's called a magnetic loop. I had something similar years and years ago made by AEA, and it seemed to work okay, but I really didn't use it a lot or check it out that much, but it did work. And MFJ makes two. Let me let it recycle.
It's sounding good, Rich. So far we've heard about the R8 half-wavelength antenna and the magnetic loop of AEA, and I'm going to make a guess that you're about to find out, you really want to know how much performance you're going to lose if, because of your more restricted operation these days, you're going to be using infinitesimal antennas, very small antennas, and compared to full half-wavelength antennas. I'm guessing you're about to ask, what's the difference in performance? Is that approximately what your question is going to be, Rich? N2EO, K2LAW.
Are you right on target, Dick? See, I want to keep maintenance to a minimum, because I can't do it myself anymore. I have to depend on other people. Maybe if you're near a computer, go to the MFJ website, and I don't know the model number, Woke up, how would you look it up? Magnetic loop antenna, probably. They make two. One covers 20 through 10. The other covers 40 through 15. I want to buy the one that covers 40 through 15 because I like 40 meters deep. It comes with a control box and a control stepper motor through the coaxial cable. I wonder what you think. How much am I going to lose? You had said that, I forget who wrote that book, that when you go to an infinitesimal dipole, and I guess this classifies as that, you get 95% of the original performance. Back to that.
Yeah, when it comes to almost any antenna, about three things make it work well. Altitude usually helps a whole lot on HF, on VHF and UHF it helps even more. You got to get above the trees and the local buildings if you want to have any real range to it. And the gain of the antenna. Now, if you're talking about antennas that really have gain, rhombics and log periodics and Yagi antennas, if you could see the beam coming out of it, it squirts like a flashlight, and you point it in the right direction, and the guy's going to hear a lot louder signal than if you use a lower gain antenna. But among the half wavelength and less antennas, if your antenna is a half wavelength long, like a dipole, it has the classic figure eight pattern. If you make a two-dimensional good diagram of it, and if you could see three-dimensional space, it's really a donut. You slice a donut in half for the short way, so to speak, and you get a figure eight pattern. So that's the pattern you get out of a dipole. The magic of a dipole, it's hard to believe, and this was first discussed by Dr. John Krause, W-H-J-K, who wrote a classic book in 1950 by McGraw-Hill called Antennas. Arguably, he wrote an antenna book that people consider the Bible on the subject. Let me drop it. And he headed the electroscience laboratory, among other things, at Ohio University. So he was a professor at Ohio University, had worked essentially all of his life with antennas, and published this very good book called Antennas, which is now in its third edition, and he's now a silent key. But there was a chapter in his first book called The Infinitesimal Dipole. And the thing that's very hard to believe, opposite of common sense, is that if you took a half-wave dipole on, let's say, for instance, 80 meters, where it normally would be 132 feet long, and you start shrinking it down shorter because you don't have enough property, or for whatever reason, you've got to squeeze it into a smaller space. So you start making the dipole 100 feet long, 80 feet long, 60 feet long, 40 foot long, 20 foot long. And common sense would lead you to believe the smaller dipole is going to have a smaller effective capture area on reception, and it's going to have lower gain on transmission. Good common sense would lead you to believe that. Absolutely not true. As you make the dipole go slowly toward infinitesimal, smaller and smaller, two things happen. Number one, the Q of the antenna goes up. In other words, its bandwidth divided into its center frequency becomes a bigger and bigger number because the bandwidth gets smaller and smaller. Full half-wave dipole on 80 meters probably gives you a reasonable visoir from a big number, 3.6 megs to 3.9 megs. In that region, you're getting a reasonable visoir. Outside of that, the visoir starts climbing pretty fast. You start making the dipole super short and re-resonate it. Let me drop this. As long as you've got the right kind of an antenna tuner, which has enough range to it, and a low enough feed line between that antenna tuner and the antenna, as long as you bring it back into resonance, you never lose more than 0.4 of a dB when compared to a full half-wave dipole at that exact same altitude. And the full half-wave dipole, you plug it into a formula that's very well accepted. Area equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You plug those real numbers in to that formula for your 80-meter half-wave dipole, and you'll find out that it has a real electronic area of 8,500 square feet. Even though the 14-gauge wire you made out of it, 132 feet long, casts a shadow on the ground of 1 square foot, radio-wise, As long as the antenna resonates, it has 8,500 square feet of area. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you look at thing broadside, you would see this great big black oval in space, about 1.5 wavelengths, about 1.5 times the width of the antenna, and about 1/3 of the height of the antenna would be the size of the oval, 8,500 square feet. As you make the dipole shorter and shorter, but keep resonating it, you never go below something like 8,000 square feet of area. The magic of resonance is that it'll still suck up the same amount of signal on reception. It'll have within 4/10 of a dB the exact same gain on transmission. You just have to live with a much more narrow antenna. You start QSYing with that narrow dipole, only 10 or 20 KC, you're going to have to retune it if it's an infinitesimal dipole. But you lose nothing in performance by making it small if it's re-resonated with low-loss materials. Let me drop. What's really happening, every dipole, the energy you launch from your transmission line on that dipole enters the dipole, and you want to believe it just jumps into space. Absolutely not. Most of that energy spreads down the wire, goes down toward the tip. About 5% of it gets radiated. All of it hits the tip, gets reflected back, and comes back to the input end of the dipole, and keeps bouncing back and forth 10 or 20 times before the energy finally gets radiated. And what you and I call resonance is to electronically tune the antenna so that all of those bounces stay in step, stay co-phased with each other. That's what resonance really is. As you make the antenna smaller and smaller, you've got less area to do the radiating. Therefore, instead of 5% of the energy radiating going down the first pass, maybe only 1% is radiated. Therefore, you're going to have 100 bounces instead of 20 bounces, if you know what I mean. And to keep them all in step, it's going to give you a higher Q or a more narrow bandwidth antenna. Every time you QSY that narrow antenna, a few KC, you're going to have to retune the antenna tuner. But that's a small price to pay. Let me drop. And the other thing that's important to know is that now that you know that a shorter antenna will run a higher Q, therefore the energy you're putting into it is going to be bouncing more times before it gets radiated, and on each pass through the antenna, if there's any lossy elements involved, like lossy piece of feed line between your antenna tuner and the shack and that antenna, and the antenna and the signal's going to bounce back and forth on that lossy feed line, you're going to lose faster. So the only thing wrong with a higher Q antenna is it's narrow band, and you better be using low loss materials. And if you have any doubt about the loss of the materials used in your antenna, there's a very simple test you could do. Run the transmitter key down at the 100-watt level for a couple of minutes. Turn off the transmitter, run over there and touch everything. If everything runs ice cold, your antenna tuner, your feed line, and the antenna itself, then by definition, it is nearly 100% efficient. Because of all the energy you're putting into it, if the antenna tuner is doing its job, none of it's reflected back to the transmitter, there's no other place it can go. It's got to be radiated into space. This is a controversial subject. You say these words in 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon, and a hell of a lot of people will say, what in the world are you smoking? You're crazy. And I'm coming up with an article that eventually is going to be on Bernie's website, K2YO, where you guys can be tapping into it, in which if you assemble two of the beautiful demonstrations by Walter Lewin of MIT, of these physics lectures on YouTube video, let me drop. Where once you understand something called the non-conservative magnetic field, every antenna has a varying magnetic field around it, which is where most of the action is coming from. And the non-conservative magnetic field that Walter Lewin does a beautiful job of explaining on two separate videos, which I'll eventually be bringing to your attention, you'll understand how the current on the dipole can be 10 or 20 times higher than the current you've launched on the transmission line, even though you've built the transmission line out of, let's say, 14-gauge wire, two pieces side by side with just the right spacing, so it's a 72-ohm transmission line going into your 72-ohm impedance dipole, and those two pieces of wire make a right-angle turn right at the end of the feed line and into the antenna, and how in the world can that exact same piece of wire have 20 amperes flowing in it in the dipole due to resonance, and yet a couple of inches away, the transmission line has only 1 ampere that you're launching. The non-conservative magnetic field phenomenon of Walter Lewin's YouTube video will make that clearer. But now, getting back to Rich's original question, and that is, do I have to look at the MFJ antennas? Do we have to look at the ISO link or whatever it was called, ISO probe? There's a number of antennas over the years that have been built that are very compact. And are we worried about the individual brand name, the individual model number? Is it going to be efficient? Let me drop. And the answer is no. You don't have to look at the brand name. You don't have to look at the model number. You don't have to care about, is it a magnetic loop? Is it an infinitesimal dipole plus antenna tuner? Once you've gone beyond half wavelength in size and you've gone smaller, once you've gone to the smaller pieces of real estate, what determines the gain and the pattern of the antenna is strictly whether or not you've resonated it, whether or not you've set it up to be horizontal or vertical. But what I'm getting at is the gain does not continue to decrease. Once you go to a half wavelength or smaller, you go larger than half wavelength, like 5/8 and full wave, you start developing more complicated antenna pattern with lobes, and some of those lobes are higher in gain. But from half wavelength down toward zero, the gain does not fall off by anything more than 4/10 of a dB if you properly resonate it with low loss materials. And if you think your antenna is lossy, the thermal test will tell you real fast. You put 100 watts into an antenna, and if 5 watts of it is being lost due to heat, you will easily feel that heat in your hand when you turn off the transmitter and go over there and touch things. And if your hand says it's ice cold, 5 watts of loss out of 100, you could easily detect, and as such, you're getting 95% efficiency, if you know what I mean. A small fraction of a dB of difference. So don't worry about what the actual antenna is once you've made it small. As long as it resonates, as long as it ties in efficiency, meaning low-loss materials, you're going to get all the performance you think you would like to get. After that, it's only a function of how high up above the ground, because no matter how small the antenna is, big or small, in the case of HF antennas, let me drop. For the most part, the vertical angle of takeoff of your signal you're transmitting is primarily a function of how many wavelengths the antenna is above the ground. You look at that ground out there and you see dirt and lawn and shrubs and whatever. To that radio wave on 80 meters, that ground of yours is a slightly fuzzy mirror. It's a slightly clouded mirror, if you know what I mean. And so there's a real antenna above the ground. There's a mirror image of that antenna below the ground. In the case of horizontal polarization, they're out of phase with each other. Therefore, you get a null on the horizon. And some number of degrees above the horizon, the two different path lengths come back into phase, and that is your elevation angle. So you can determine the elevation angle of the antenna primarily by its altitude on HF frequencies. So you don't have to worry about the brand name, the model number, and whether it's called a loop kind of antenna, whether it's an infinitesimal dipole-like antenna, they're all running on the same physics. You're pouring a certain amount of energy into the antenna. Let me drop.
KBY, you have another comment.
Okay, Chris recognized. I'll go over to him in a second. You pour a certain amount of antenna energy into that antenna, and as long as you've made it out of low-loss materials, and as long as you're smart enough to make sure it resonates at your favorite frequency, then it has no choice but to radiate that signal into space, and it's going to be radiating into space in something very close to a dipole-like pattern. Let's see what Chris has got to say. KB2IQN, K2LIW. Go ahead, Chris.
Just want to bring one thing, is you mentioned using a low-loss feed line in the case of a small antenna because of high Q. And I don't see how that makes much of a difference unless you've got a high SWR and you're using an antenna tuner. That's the only way in which the reflection is going to have to bounce up and down the feed line. Otherwise, it's just like any other antenna as far as I'm concerned. Back to Nat, KB2IQN.
What you said, Chris, KB2IQN, Mobile, K2RW, would be absolutely true if we always located the antenna tuner or the tuning resonating network at the antenna. Then the transmission line would have the signal going from the transmitter down the transmission line once, and it would be radiated into space. And the nice thing about a half-wave dipole, if you make it full, half-wave in size, is that it is a 72-ohm impedance, beautiful low-loss antenna, and no visoir. As you start making the antenna shorter, by definition, by the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, you can predict exactly ahead of time what the resistive component, what the reactive component is going to be. As you make the antenna exactly a half wavelength long, the resistive component is 72 ohms, the reactive component is zero, and that's very desirable if you're using 72 ohm line. And by the way, 50 ohm line is close enough. Not to worry. Let me drop. However, those so-called Brown and Woodward curves, which you can get a hold of them by going to the website of Dr. Tom Williams, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org. You go to that so-called microwave website, you go to the bottom of the page, you'll find dipole information by K2RIW. You'll see the two Brown and Woodward curves, and you'll see a 1,500-word article explaining. The bottom line is that as you make the dipole shorter than half wave, the 72 ohms starts going down towards zero. And by the way, if you make it longer than half wave, the 72 ohms starts going up to close to 2,000 ohms. So the resistive component is going to start coming down towards zero as you make the dipole shorter and shorter. That's half the story. The other half the story is the reactance that was nothing when you were at exactly half wavelength, you're going to start building up a huge capacitor reactance. You make that 80-meter dipole that should be 132 feet long. You make it 32 feet long. I don't know the exact number, but you're probably going to have something in the vicinity of 1.6 ohms of resistance and something like 1,500 ohms of capacitor reactance. The Vizsla antenna is probably going to be 500 to 1. As long as you've got the antenna tuner right at the antenna and resonating it right there, everything's hunky-dory. If the antenna tuner is in the shack, that huge, high standing wave ratio antenna is going to have energy bouncing back and forth on that transmission line back down to the antenna tuner, because that's what's forcing it back into resonance. That's what's matching that 1.6 ohm resistive component, bringing it up to 50 ohms. That's what's getting rid of the 1,500 ohms of capacitor reactance. The antenna tuner, if it's in the shack with you, let me drop. And now the resonating energy that normally is bouncing back and forth in the antenna itself, if it was half wavelength long, now the transmission line is going to absorb all of those 500 bounces you're going to get with that infinitesimal dipole. Therefore, your energy that you're launching out of your transmitter is flowing through that transmission line, in my crazy example, 500 times, and you're going to get a hell of a lot more loss. So either you're going to, in that infinitesimal dipole, you're going to put the tuning network right at the antenna to avoid that transmission line extra loss, or you're going to use honking real big transmission like Andrew, inch and five-eighths Andrew Heliacs to make sure the transmission line is so low in loss that it doesn't matter. Many guys have had an extremely high Q antenna work very, very well, and without spending a whole lot of money to get very low loss in the transmission line by making it open wire line, 600 ohm open wire line. It's pretty hard to make that lossy, if you know what I mean, because it's essentially air everywhere as long as you've used it correctly. So I wonder if that makes a little more sense where the extra loss comes from if you start making the antenna shorter and non-resonant length. KB2IQN, K2LIW in the TechNet. Yeah, Chris is mobile. One more call. Are you still there, Chris? Transmission line, and people have gotten away with that with open wire line, but You may, if you insist on it being coax, then it better be some really fancy coax. So everyone believes that once you go to a small antenna, because you don't have much real estate to operate with, you think you're going to get degraded performance. And if you're smart enough, the answer is you don't have to lose anything more than a couple of percent of the performance. So it's just a matter of making sure you've got resonance, making sure that between your transmitter and that antenna is hopefully a good antenna tuning network right at the antenna. It doesn't have to be an expensive antenna tuner at the antenna. Once you go to the Brown and Woodward curves, I've told you how to get to them, once you go the length of your wire of your antenna, like maybe it's a tenth of a wavelength long instead of a half wave, and once you know you're making out a 14-gauge wire, the Brown and Woodward curve will tell you exactly what impedance that very small dipole is going to give you. Once you know that impedance, you go to the so-called Berkeley website. Let me drop. You Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, plus impedance matching. You put that combination of words together and your search engine with Google or whatever, and you'll find the Berkeley program. And Berkeley will say, what is the impedance of your transmitter? And you'll write down 50 ohms for the resistor component and 0 ohms for the reactive component. The next question Berkeley is going to ask you is, what is the impedance of the load? And from the Brown and Woodward curve, you find out it's a 1.6 ohm resistor and a 1500 ohm capacitor. And Brown and Woodward, and the Berkeley equation is going to ask you, what frequency are you on? You give it those three or four pieces of information and you press go. And in one fraction of a second, Berkeley will give you 16 solutions. L networks, pi networks, L pi networks, T networks, and so on. Choose the one you like. In the case of a simple L network, one simple inductor, one simple capacitor in series with it, you either feed the center tap and use the outer edges, or feed the outer edges and use the center tap. But one simple inductor, one simple capacitor on the L network at your favorite frequency will give you a perfect impedance match on that ridiculously small dipole. And you could mount that right at the antenna if you want to. At least on that one favorite frequency, it'll give you a perfect match. The feed line will be low in loss. You spent very little money. You didn't have to put the antenna tuner out there in the weather, if you know what I mean. To weatherproof that inductor and that capacitor a little bit, put it into a plastic box. But it's a beautiful solution, and all of those resources to do that are there. And this isotoner or this MFJ antenna, it probably has the equivalent of an L network built into it, so that even though the antenna is physically small in size, non-resonant in its physical dimensions, let me drop. If MFJ or whoever else built it put the right kind of a tuning network into it so that it presents to you a 50 or a 70 ohm load and you use reasonable low loss transmission line to it, or if you bought the version which is coming out with 450 or 600 ohms and you set it with 600 ohm open line, then you can get all the efficiency you want in a small dipole, in a small loop antenna, as long as you're willing to live with narrow frequency regions of operation. And if you want a QSY to some other frequency, you must retune it to re-resonate it. And once you're willing to do that, then you lose essentially nothing with these small antennas in your QTH. That's part of the story, Rich. I hope it helps. N2EO, the RF voice of Massapequa Park, K2RAW. Go ahead, Rich. Okay, K2RAW, set that line on. Well, I know you know what you're talking about. You, what, have about 20 some odd patents on antennas registered at the patent office. I know that. Yes, you know, if you get a chance, it doesn't have to be now, because I don't want to take up any more net time. But go to MFJ and look it up. You'll see. They have going down in the center of the antenna, a plastic box, and there's a stepper motor and a capacitor in there, is what I believe. There's his dough. I mean, that'll be set. All right, years ago, there was a company called AEA. I don't know if they were just out of the Hamptons or out of Kansas totally. And they made a competition, I had it, it seemed to work, and that's exactly what they had in there, a stepper motor.
motor driving a capacitor. So I assume with that capacitor up there that the lower feed point not that, but I think I'm probably going to just be on the safe side. I don't need a very long run. I'm going to use LMR 400. And just as a side note, I'm downsizing the station because my whole life has changed since surgery and I'm getting a paraplegic and I'll have to get somebody to put all this stuff up for me. But I'm going to get rid of a lot of stuff. I've been promised a 2000 by my lady friend and pay 160 through 1296 radio. We get through the other stuff. I'll get a Canon camera for Christmas because she likes taking pictures of her grandson. Anyway, that's all I got to say, Dick. Thank you very much. KTYYW, check that Highmark and 2EO.
Yeah, considering the number of people who have signed in, we've spent a little too much time on Rich's problem. However, it is an extremely universal one, and it's a controversial subject, controversial method of explanation that I've been giving you guys, and I think it has sufficient value that's worth spending some extra time on it. Stop losing sleep over the fact that your antenna is too small, as long as you're smart enough to properly re-resonate it. And when it comes to remotely re-resonating it, whether it be a so-called screwdriver antenna or some kind of a stepper motor, which steps through the capacitor variation for you when you QSY, as long as at the antenna itself it is re-resonated, all this magic happens. Magic of resonance and the high Q. Because the signal is bouncing back and forth on a real half-wave dipole something like 20 times, the current in the dipole itself is 20 times higher than the current you've launched with your transmission line. As such, the current in the dipole is 20 times higher than it would be if it wasn't resonated. 20 times higher current makes 20 times higher strong magnetic field, and that's what really kicks the resonance or kicks the radiation process in the tail and makes it start happening. So magnetics are all the magic there, if you know what I mean. Mel, K2 Mike Charlie, the one of the radio voices of Huntington. Go right ahead, Mel, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Yo, Dick, I want to say thank you very, very much. And just turn it over to Mel.
Well, thank you both very, very much. This is Mel, K2MC, and you're right about Huntington. I have a very brief question, an easy question. The answer may not be so easy, but it will be fast, I'm sure. It has nothing to do with RF or antennas. It's a very simple question. I've been told by a number of people that my audio is on the low side, and I've been trying to get either a schematic or a service manual. I tried on the internet. I tried Yaesu's website to get information as to where I can locate mic gain control in this particular Yaesu rig. It's a model FT2200. It's a bit of an oldie, purchased in 1996. So, Dick, I don't know if you have the answer to this question, but perhaps someone on the net may. This is K2MC.
I hope that Mel is, I hope, here we go. Hal is present, because this is the exact question that Hal says he's got the answer to. K6DPZ, the man who collects information on older rigs. Hal, go right ahead if you're available. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet, K6DPZ. Well, if you'd be nice enough to give me a call tomorrow, I could possibly pull a manual and I could possibly give him the information. We have a large library on Yaesu. K2RIW, K6, Dark Purple Zombies.
Very fine, Hal. He did say Yaesu Fox Tango 2200. Now, Mel, the good news is that, in my opinion, the audio I hear from you, because I'm wearing earphones, and the audio I'm hearing from myself right now are almost identical. I heard you getting ear reports earlier today where somebody was telling you your audio is low. I think that particular guy was using a low gain setting on his receiver. And from my point of view, your audio is very close to the right number. Let's see what Hal says. Hal, I think he doesn't have to boost that audio at all. I think he's very close to the right number. K6DPZ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K6DPZ. Dick, it's very hard to really judge because he's going through the repeater. I don't know what type of compression amplifiers are in the repeater to bring the audio up to level. So, you know, on the input, you can listen to his level and tell, but through the repeater, it may be low, but it may be brought up to a high enough standard of deviation to go through.
Okay, the amount of deviation I'm using on this rig has not changed in 20 years. Very few people tell me my audio is too high or too low. It's close to the right number, I believe. And Mel being close enough to me in Huntington, I can hear him on the input. His audio level on the input is very close to mine. So, Mel, I don't think you need to readjust that rig. Before you touch it, I think if you start increasing it, you're going to go too far. If you decrease it, I think you're going to go too far. You're so close to where you should be that until you get a chance to visit somebody like Andy, the B2CDL, at any one of the Limont functions, where at any one of the Limont functions he brings along his service monitor, and he can measure the exact number of kilohertz of deviation your rig is giving you when you say hello into the microphone, or hello, if you know what I mean. So I wouldn't change it, Mel. I'd leave it alone. K2 Mike Charlie for any further comments. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Thank you for your input. Appreciate it from you and from Hal. This isn't the first time I was told that the audio is a little on the low side. I've gotten reports in the past. The important thing is, how does it compare to others on the channel? If it's pretty much on par with everybody else, I'd be more than happy to accept it the way it is. But when I get reports that it's lower than others, then I start to worry about it, or wonder about it at any rate. But anyway, is Hal the one who has the information? If so, I'd appreciate the phone number.
I think Hal is listed in QIZ.com, but what's the easiest way he can get your phone number, Hal? Or do you want to give it out? K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Dick, I really should not give it out. Somebody else should. There's reasons. K6DPZ.
Understand.
An email?
Would he be able to email you, Hal, by your call letters at arol.net? Over to you, Hal.
Yeah, just email me at landaircom@aol.com. That's all. landaircom@aol.com. K6DPZ. And I'm good in the call book also.
Jake, do you want me to give out Hal's phone number? I have it here. If Hal's in agreement for that, Hal, do you want Bernie? Here we go. Do you want N2MB to give out your phone number? Hal, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I just don't want to give it out. It's a form of commercializing, and I'm not going to take the chance of showing commercializing on this repeater.
Barry, go right ahead.
Okay, real good. Phone number that I have here is 51... Oh, God, the phone just went dead. Okay, here you go. That was terrible. 516-303-2051. That's 516-303-2051. That should be a good phone number, Val.
That's the cell.
Okay, yeah, Mel, do you need a fill on any of that?
No, I have it. Yeah, I have it. And if Hal doesn't mind, I'll try to give a call tomorrow sometime, see what kind of information he may have available. I was hoping that I'd get it from Yaesu. It's in the form of a link that I could download it from. But, you know, you indicate what rig do you have or something like that. And this particular model is way too old. It's not listed on their website, so I'll probably be out of luck. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I do appreciate the information. This is K2MC.
Info.
Comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
I agree with you on the assessment of his audio quality. The only thing I hear is the breath popping. That audio level sounds perfect to me.
Okay, he may be speaking a little bit closer to the mic. Rich, briefly give us your info. Go ahead.
Okay, fine, Dick. You know, I used to be in that service business. I no longer do it, only for myself. But you know what a lot of people do? Many people do this, they make a mistake. Most rigs have a deviation control and a mic gain control. And for some reason, everybody goes for the deviation control. And a lot of times, that's the wrong thing to do. Mel, you want to put that rig, I don't care if it's Hal, or Andy, or the man in the moon. You want to put that rig on a service monitor. And don't forget, you're riding PL on top of that. So you want to run the deviation at around 4.5 kilohertz, maybe 4.75 kilohertz on the deviation, and then adjust the mic gain to the proper level. Back to that.
Yeah, the right way to do it is with a service monitor, looking at the oscilloscope and so on, because you want the right ratio of a PL tone, the right ratio of audio, and the right level of speech compression. A mic gain goes in front of a speech compressor. The output of the speech compressor, speech clipper, call it what you like, speech processor, then goes into the deviation control, which really gives you the amount of deviation. You don't want the deviation to be too wide where you start popping out of the sides of the IF strip of this repeater, and you'll get the blanking of your audio and blanking of your RF. You also don't want to set the audio mic gain so high that you're starting to make audio square waves, if you know what I mean. And when the rig is over-deviating, sometimes periodically will remove the PL tone for short periods of time, and you'll pop out of the repeater. So right now, I think his rig, except for a little bit of speech popping from his being close to the mic, is pretty close to the right deviation. But once it's put in front of a good service monitor, you'll get it. And when it comes to the FT2200, an older rig, there's a good chance that Hal, who collects the information on older rigs, will have what you're looking for. Next person on the list was Ed, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Tango Yankee. Go right ahead, Ed, K2RIW in the TechNet. One more call, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Tango Yankee. Are you there, Ed? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Ed got called away. The next person on the list was Jim. Haven't heard from you for a couple of weeks, Jim. And how are things in your neck of the woods? KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee. K2RIW. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, hey, Dick. I haven't been on the text in a while. I haven't signed in a while. I've been pretty busy, and I haven't been on the radio in a while either. So hoping to get back into it, and hopefully this will be enough for the next few weeks. But tonight I had a question because I have a problem where I have trouble feeding my antennas into my house without getting bugs into the room, which isn't the biggest problem, but it's not very nice to have. So what I'll do is I'll crack a window and then I'll run coax into it, and then the bugs will get in under the window. I know it's kind of a silly question, but how exactly do you feed coax into your house without stuff from the outside getting in?
KC2YDP with it.
Okay, I think I'm hearing Matt dropping out, but I think I'm hearing you, Matt. KC2YDT with information. I'll get to you in a second. One of the things you're going to discover, Jim, is that running one piece of coax out to your antennas outside the house is rarely enough. As you do more and more tinkering, you're going to be put up second, third, fourth, and fifth antennas. There's eventually going to be a number of antennas out there if you stick with this hobby most of the time. And the way one of the guys solved the problem is there's a zillion solutions. The way I solved it is to install a dryer vent. In other words, I drilled it's a 3.5 or 4-inch diameter hole in the wall, installed a metal tube that's part of a dryer vent, as if I was putting a dryer on the second floor of the house. It's the second bedroom of my house where I've done this to. Then I run the coax cables through that dryer vent to go through the wall and stuff up the extra area left over with the right kind of foam or pieces of cloth. It's not an ideal solution, but it's pretty good. And by way, the portion of the dryer vent that's outside the house acts as a kind of a weather protection device where the water is pushed off, going back into the house, so to speak. And you can also tilt this thing a little bit. That's one way guys do it. Another way guys do it is they'll install a panel that they make up out of metal or fiberboard, where they open up the window, put this panel across the empty space that goes all the way from left to right side of the window, and bring the window back down on it. And so now it produces a pretty good weather seal. And then this extra panel that they've created, let me drop. The panel has a number of feed-through connectors, type N, UHF, or whatever. And so the coax inside the house connects to the feed-through connector at the panel on the inside, and then there's another piece of coax outside the house that picks up the other end of the feed-through connector on that panel. Those are the two main ways I know of that people do it, a feed-through panel or a dryer vent hole filled up with the extra space where you're... The nice thing about the dryer vent is that you can always add more cables to it. My guess is if you really wanted to, you could probably put 15 or 10 pieces of RG8 cable through that dryer vent hole. And then you just got to do a pretty good job of filling up the extra space left over with good tight pieces of foam or whatever. And it will keep out the insects, weather, and so on. I've been doing that for lots of years, and it's good enough for me. Let's see what Matt's got to say. KC2, the YDT, K2RIW. Go ahead, Matt.
NY2HF, what a comment.
KC2YDT. Okay, well, I'm upstate, so don't know how much you'll get. But if you go to KJI Electronics, they sell a power board strictly for that purpose. It's a piece of PVC, not PVC, plexiglass with two barrel connectors on it. I put that up with air conditioning foam around the areas, and that works fine. I want more. I just drilled another hole and put another barrel connector on that piece and set. But it's specifically made for the windows, and it costs around $20-$30 if I believe. Again, that's KJI Electronics. K2RIW, KC2YDT Mobile.
That was a comment after
NY2HF.
Yeah, Dennis recognized, and so the $20 or $30 solution with KJI, with the plexiglass, I think you could homebrew that out of plexiglass with a little bit cheaper and put your feed-through connectors through it. The guys out there in Cutchogue get some pretty strong weather from time to time, so let's see how Dennis has solved that one. NY2HF, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. A lot of people will run a 2-inch PVC pipe from the irrigation access through the foundation. But for Jim's application, what he could simply do is go down to a hardware store and go and buy a package of 3/4 pipe insulation, which is foam. And what he has to do is take it and put it down where the coaxial comes through the window, and put another piece, cut it to size, to go where the window doesn't meet at the top because it's open slightly, which will insulate against the cold weather that we're having now. The other thing he may want to do is take a 2x4 or something of that sort and put it on top of the window so nobody can open the window once he has this in place, because there's no safety. They can somebody can just open up the window. Back to the net.
Contact. Yeah, you brought a very interesting point up that I forgot about entirely, Dennis, and that is when the window is raised because you put an extra panel of plexiglass, wood, or whatever with your feed-through connectors, your double male connectors, double female connectors installed in it. Because the window is raised, you've now created an air gap at the top that's got to be filled up with the right kind of foam and an extra board is required as a safety device to make sure the window cannot be opened any further by somebody pushing on it from the outside. Those are two very good suggestions.